It's your old pal, Ariel Helwani, on this Wednesday, May 22nd, 2019. Welcome back to a brand new episode of the MMA Reporters, right here on ESPN, on all the platforms. The fastest growing podcast at ESPN, that's what I was told. From Daniel just moments ago. He told me that our producer, he said it's the fast that they are just losing their minds over in Bristol by how fast the show is just spreading all over the place. Everyone downloading. They just can't get enough. They cannot get enough of the MMA Reporters. That's what I've been told. And so I'm just relaying that to all of you. We've got a fun show planned for all of you today. Actually, it's a really different kind of show, and I like it very much. I'm very excited about this show. My now former colleague, Shamatkar Sandhu, we worked together for the past year at ESPN. He's been covering mixed martial arts on and off for the past 7 or so years. He announced this morning that he is leaving the journalism side of things, and he is going to work for the PFL, for the Professional Fighters League, in their social media department. And you may know him. He's been on the show before. He's been on the Monday show. He's been on this show. And he is very good when it comes to social media. And this is a great gig for him. But it's interesting, anytime someone goes from the, you know, independent media side of things to the promotional side of things. And so I'm curious about that career change. We'll also check in with my old pal, the Brazilian beast himself, Guilherme Cruz. Worked with him for many years at MMAfighting.com, and he is one of the hardest working journalists in the game. No one covers the Brazilian scene quite like him, and a lot has been going on this past month as far as Brazilian MMA is concerned, and so I thought it would be fun to have my old friend Guilherme Cruz on the program. But first, let us say hello to Old Faithful himself, New York Rick, who joins us from our Bristol bureau. New York Rick, how are you?
I'm doing well, my friend. How are you?
I'm doing great. Last week when we spoke at the top of the show, I broke the news that we are taking our show on the road for the first time. We're taking it to Chicago, June 7th to be exact, Lincoln Hall to be even more exact. And 2 days after tickets have gone on sale, I am very proud to report, New York Rick, that a lot of people are excited about this. And how do I know that they're excited? A lot of people have bought tickets. In fact, I'm told there's only around 50 or so tickets left. And so they are getting snatched up by the second. And if you missed the rundown on Monday, these are the details. This is how you can get tickets to the very first Ariel Helwani's MMA show live recording on location in front of all of you. And let me tell you, we are talking about some exciting things. Some fun things are in the works. You want to be a part of this. I'm not just saying it. I'm not lying. These aren't wolf tickets. It's the real deal. Friday, June 7th, Lincoln Hall, doors open at 7, show starts at 8, there's going to be a meet and greet after the show, there'll be food, drinks, all that stuff and more. The event is for 18 and older, the 18 and older crowd, if you will. All seating is general admission and tickets are just $30. All you have to do is go to eventbrite.com and search my name, Ariel Helwani, eventbrite.com, search Ariel Helwani, and that's how you can get your tickets. June 7th, night before UFC 238. If you're going to 238, it's a great thing to do the night before. Even if you're not going, we will welcome you with open arms. No discrimination. I hope to see you there. Again, eventbrite.com. That's E-V-E-N-T, bright, B-R-I-T-E.com. Go there right now. Search my name. That's how you can get the tickets, all right? And here, Quick, I heard, is going to be in attendance.
I would not miss it for the world. And by the time you're hearing this, you're probably behind. You know, these are going so fast you might want to snatch them up as soon as you hear this.
And in all honesty, I mean, the whole reason why it's the fastest growing podcast is because of the fans. We couldn't even keep it in the studio. It's growing so fast, we had to take it out on the road.
There you go. And that's from Daniel himself, who, by the way, I was sort of trying to set you up to come in and like back me when I was talking about the fastest growing.
Yeah, I thought about that.
But you know what? It's good the way you did it here. It's very organic. You know, it just seemed like we didn't plan it beforehand.
No, so totally.
I like the way you did that very subtly. So yes, so that's exciting. That's June 7th. But now let's talk a little mixed martial arts. And I want to start with New York Rick this week because for the past 2 or so years, this man has been banging the Felicia Spencer drum. He's been telling me to have her on the show. He's been telling me to have her come on because she's a fellow Montrealer, although on Monday I kind of found out it's a bit of a fugazi situation. But anyway, I'm still going to claim her. And now all of a sudden, here she is. She comes to the UFC. She runs right through Megan Anderson, and all of a sudden, here we are talking about her fighting Chris Cyborg. And so before I actually ask you about that, I want to give you the opportunity to say I told you so. You can say, like, Israel Adesanya, that's BS. Like, you didn't tell us anything about him. But in this case, Felicia Spencer, you did tell us first about her. So go ahead, do your thing.
You know, I can take no credit. Felicia's done all the hard work. What an incredible athlete. And I will not take this opportunity to gloat. I will just congratulate Felicia Spencer on a fantastic debut.
Are you surprised she went right through Megan like that?
I'm not, because I think stylistically, once it went to the ground there, that was an area where Felicia's shown that she's very, very slick. She's very good at keeping control. You may notice if you were, you know, watching, there was a time where it looked like she was a little high on Megan's back. And it looked like Megan might have been able to buck her off, but that's something that she, kind of does and is comfortable doing. She can very quickly, get position, you know, reposition herself on somebody's back. She's fantastic there. So I thought if it went there, there was an opportunity for it to end that quickly. So I was not surprised. I think Felicia Spencer is a true 145er and one of the, you know, best in that division, which doesn't have many notable names. You know, you win one, against, Megan Anderson, and all of a sudden the conversation is about Cyborg because of how thin that division is.
Okay, so then let me ask you about that, because it feels like if this were any other weight class, someone like Felicia Spencer would not be in the discussion to fight a Chris Cyborg. That's absolutely ludicrous. But unfortunately, at 145, different set of rules. I would argue that 145 has actually never been healthier than it is right now, with Felicia Spencer, with Chris Cyborg still there as a non-champion, with Nunes. We're not quite sure if she's going to defend the title, but it's still okay. I would like to see a Macy Chaisson go back up to 145, not fight at 135. She had trouble making that weight. I just don't – I feel like it would be such a mistake to have Felicia Spencer fight Chris Cyborg next. And I understand why Chris is doing this. In case you don't know, Chris has one fight left on her contract, and her contract expires in August. And so she wants to get that one more fight in before the contract expires. That's why she's pushing for July 27th in Edmonton, so that she can get back on the winning track and so that she has a lot more leverage when she becomes a free agent, as opposed to now where she's coming off a loss. So it all makes sense. I like what Felicia Spencer is saying. Essentially, like, if you want me to fight this girl, I'll fight her, but you got to pay me. Yana Kunitskaya made $300,000 to fight her. I'm down, but I'm not going to make $30,000 to fight Chris Cyborg. So I like that she had, you know, the cojones to say that, or as I said on Ariel and the Bad Guy today, the chutzpah to say that, even though she's 1-0. But if we're putting aside all that stuff, she should not be fighting Chris Cyborg, right? It's too soon.
Yeah, it's too soon. I think a fighter like Felicia, who, you know, doesn't have as many professional fights as somebody who you would expect to fight Chris Cyborg at this point in their career, could definitely use some seasoning. So you could use some more cage time in the UFC. Now, granted, you know, she's been fighting in Invicta, and that is, you know, the notch right below where you're getting yourself ready for the UFC stage. But I do think it could be a situation where, much like they did with the 145-pound division to this point, is bringing up 35ers that are willing to take a fight against a 45er. I don't think that there's any secret that this division needs some people who are willing to kind of go between, like Amanda Nunes has and captured the title in both divisions. So I could see next for Felicia Spencer, if not Cyborg, and it wouldn't shock me if that fight was the one that was made. Somebody coming up from 35, you mentioned Macy Chaisson. I think she certainly is somebody who's trying to stay at 35 as opposed to somebody who would gladly go to 45. She is making a very concerted effort, because that is not an easy cut. I think it'd be more likely to see somebody who has floated between maybe Kat Zingano, maybe Holly Holm, somebody in that territory who is also a step up. But I could see that more readily than I would see somebody who's a prospect at bantamweight.
I have to admit, I'm surprised that you're not puffing your chest out a little more. I mean, you called this one a long time ago.
You know, I mean, you mentioned Israel Adesanya, you mentioned Felicia Spencer. I am the prospect whisperer. Maybe I know. Maybe I have
again,
this foresight.
But again, you didn't call Israel Adesanya.
Yeah, you know,
you jumped on that bandwagon way late. It was like a hindsight. Like, oh yeah, I cover. I like kickboxing. I've been to Glory events.
Yeah.
That's my guy. I'm supposed to say this. This fits the narrative. This is my gimmick. In this regard, you actually have been telling me to have her on the show, and she's very lovely. What do you make of Megan Anderson? Because it feels like I always felt, I'm not trying to pile it on.
Yeah.
But I always felt like she was a really bad matchup for Cyborg, in the sense that, like, Cyborg was a bad matchup for her. Like, it would not be good if she fought her. I just didn't, at 145, like we're talking about with Spencer, you get rushed. Spencer, I could see, like, she has a forte. She's great on the ground. She's been practicing jujitsu, like she said, since she was like 10 or 11. Yep. So it all makes sense. But Megan, I don't know what to make of her at this point. I mean, She'll have a home in the UFC, I think, for as long as she wants because she's a true 145er. But like maybe a 155 division in PFL makes more sense for her because it just doesn't seem like she's able to put it together against the kind of opponents that the UFC is putting her in there with, you know, the Holly Holmes of the world.
Yeah, I think the level of competition is important to note here. You know, that there are no gimmies in that division. And you mentioned, you know, not potentially being ready for Cyborg. If we rewind to the time where that fight would have possibly been made, there's nobody that you would have said is ready for Cyborg. Cyborg was crushing everybody at that time until Amanda Nunes, you know, dethroned her. So I think, you know, Megan Anderson has not been training as long as, you know, some of the fighters that she's going to be up against. She has physical gifts that allow her to elevate her game and to be in this conversation and be in, that upper echelon of talent at the heavier weight classes. But she hasn't been fighting for long enough to say, yes, she's going to be able to rebound and put it together. You don't know what, you know, what that looks like. You don't know her mental state. You don't know how she's dealing with this loss. But I do think, if she sticks with it, if she has the physical tools, she has the gift to be able to continue to improve, and I have no doubt that she would remain near the top if she was able to do that.
Can I ask you about something else that happened on Saturday, and not specifically about what happened on Saturday, but a story that was big this weekend that was playing out on Saturday, and that's Deontay Wilder. Deontay Wilder,
yes,
won on Saturday via vicious knockout, and he was the big story of the weekend, and it all started with his comments a couple days before his fight where he essentially said that he wanted to kill Dominic Brazil because it's allowed in our sport, right? I'm allowed to do this sort of thing. I'm paraphrasing here, but everyone knows the comments, right?
Yep.
And I was very surprised that the mainstream sports media were so affected by this. We're all up in arms about this. And to me, I mean, this is the kind of thing, like, first of all, I don't believe that Deontay Wilder or any other fighter, by the way, any other prize fighter is actually trying to kill his opponent. I don't believe that at the highest of levels. Like, if we're talking about, you know, trailer park combat sports, then maybe it's a little different. But at the highest of levels, I think these men and women recognize, even if the hatred is so deep, I think they recognize that if they actually kill their opponent, it would be bad for them. It would be very bad for them. And so I was surprised to hear people get all up in arms about this because Deontay Wilder is a showman. Deontay Wilder knows how to sell a fight, and that's all that was. And, you know, when I put this out there and I said, guys, this is just a part of the show. Like, he's great at verbalizing this kind of hatred, this kind of narrative, this kind of approach to a fight. He's great at it. But, like, let's not kid ourselves. He's not actually trying to kill someone. I got a lot of people saying to me, like, oh, you've never seen someone die in the ring. How dare you talk about that? Oh, you should use your platform in better ways. Like, what are you guys talking about? Like, we've heard this before. We've heard people say this before. Frank Mir lost his job with Versus when he said this about Brock Lesnar. I thought that that was an overreaction. I've heard Chuck Liddell and others say this about their opponents. I mean, like, come on. I feel like there is a line. You know, the Conor stuff crossed the line, in my opinion. Religion, family, that should not be talked about. But here, like, it's all fair. It's all fair. It doesn't bother me. How did you feel about it?
Yeah, it didn't bother me, but I can understand why that type of language is a hot topic. I think more, you know, interestingly than where you fall on the, is it just, you know, bloviating or is there something truly behind it? Because let's be real, if Deontay Wilder intended to actually physically harm this man in a way that was not within the rules of boxing, there are plenty of avenues to be able to do that. You know, you can make a threat to somebody and then follow through with it outside of the confines of let's go into a boxing ring and compete under these specific rule sets with this specific referee. You take it outside and all of a sudden, you know, those rules don't exist. So if you're truly intending to harm somebody, that is not the best way to go about doing it. So I'm with you that I fall on the side of, look, it's just talk. I don't really buy into it. But I think more interestingly, saying this was not, you know, any accident by Deontay Wilder. You mentioned him being a showman, but beyond that, he's smart. This kind of talk was something that got him attention in a time when boxers are not getting as much attention as they used to. I think some of the shock from what he said comes from the fact that people aren't talking like this anymore. So he used this opportunity to make a stand and to say, I'm going to get the attention by telling you what I intend to do to this man, and it's going to be shocking, it's going to be crass, and you're going to pay attention to it. And when that knockout happened, the world was paying attention, and he delivered. So I think it was executed perfectly from his perspective. And personally, my take on it is I don't have a problem with that kind of language because I don't believe it. I don't buy it. As somebody who is, you know, this tuned into combat sports, it doesn't affect me in that way.
Okay, these are the comments, just for the record, so no one is confused by what we're talking about. Quote, his life is on the line for this fight, and I do mean his life. I'm still trying to get me a body on my record. Dominic Brazils asked for this. This is the only sport where you can kill a man and get paid for it at the same time. It's legal. So why not use my right to do so? And then, this is end quote, and then he kind of had a little bit of a smirk when he said that. And then, oh, by the way, when the fight was done, he was like, nah, I respect the guy, yeah. You know what I mean? And so, look, he's vicious. He's absolutely vicious. But he's absolute must-see TV. I love watching Deontay Wilder fight. I love watching any heavyweight, you know, boxer fight. I love the heavyweight division, period. Who doesn't? If you're going to fall for this, if you're going to fall for this kind of rhetoric, if you're going to fall for this kind of narrative, I feel like it's just a lack of understanding of what, you know, combat sports is, what these guys are doing. I don't subscribe to the notion when people say, you've never fought before, how dare you criticize them? Like, then I can't even do this. You know, anyone who's commenting on MMA, on politics, on movies, who hasn't made a movie, who hasn't run for president, who hasn't fought, like, then what, we're all just useless? No, it doesn't work that way. We all know it doesn't work that way. I also believe, on the flip side, that who are we to tell these men and women what to say or not to say before a fight? They do things like climb into a cage or ring that we can never fathom doing. I would never do that in a million years. I don't possess that DNA. I have no intention. I have no belief that I can stand there for a second. I would crumble due to the pressure, the nerves. I would soil myself. I can't even wrap my head around what they do for a living, time and again, cutting weight, all this stuff and more. So who am I to say what he can or can't say? Now, if he actually went in there and did something illegal, then we got a big problem on our hands. But to get all up in arms and to say we're going to do an investigation, come on, relax.
I would counter with the question, though, then what, you know, you mentioned Conor and Habib crossing the line, but now you just mentioned not being able to police that. So does that line exist, or is that a personal thing? Is that within each individual, or is there a line? Is there a bright red line?
I don't know if the UFC really has this kind of power, but they did come out and say, we've talked to both camps and we've asked them to cool it as it pertains to Conor and Khabib. And since then, they have cooled it for the most part, right? They've cooled it for the most part. I'm okay with that, but for Nevada to say we're going to police, for the WBC to say we're going to police, that seems like a little much.
Yep.
I mean, honestly, this kind of stuff, not this particular kind of stuff, but who out there is saying, I want less trash talk in MMA? I want less trash talk in combat sports. Who's saying that? Every time someone gets personal, every time someone says something that really is like, oh, we love it. I mean, look, we're talking about, you know, I've been talking all week long. It's Memorial Day weekend coming up. And historically, you know, the UFC has always held a big event Memorial Day weekend. And one of the best rivalries in the history of the UFC played out on Memorial Day weekend. It wasn't a great card, but it was Rampage versus Rashad. Black on black crime, right? They got personal with each other back and forth. We love that sort of thing. We've always loved that sort of thing. And so I just feel like everyone wants to come out and pretend like, oh, we should be better than that. We should rise above this. It's supposed to be about sport. It's supposed to be about who's the better man. Get out of here. You don't respond to that. Buy the tickets for that.
Yeah, let me just say this, and we could put a bow on it, is that nobody who hadn't heard Deontay Wilder is going to pay attention. If Deontay Wilder had walked in there and said, you know, I'm going to give my best effort, I'm going to knock this guy out, blah, 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 not one single extra person is going to pay attention to that. Due to what he said, he's going to upset a lot of people, but he's also going to get some people to pay attention, and ultimately he was successful in that, and I think us talking about it is even further proof of that.
What are your favorite Memorial Day memories?
Yeah, I mean, obviously knowing my fandom, the BJ Penn knee against Sean Sherk at UFC 84 obviously stands out as one of my favorites, but there have been some bangers. I don't know. How do you want to do this? Do you want to potentially talk about yours and then we go back and forth?
I asked you. Go ahead.
I love Penn. Because I actually had some time
Sean Sherk
to take a look at this.
By the way, I bought tickets to that event. That was my first year, full year covering MMA, and I felt like I needed to be there. I was not credentialed. UFC would not credential me, but I wanted to be there for a big Memorial Day weekend card because it was starting to become a thing. You know, the year prior, Rampage had knocked out Chuck Liddell, UFC 71, and so I was there in attendance. Remember the narrative, the big story going into that one was, in addition to the Penn one, was Lyoto Machida against Tito Ortiz, and it was the whole, like, Tito Ortiz, is he gonna beat Machida? Are they going to get rid of him? So that was a lot of fun. Anyhow, I was there, but I was not there as a journalist per se, even though I was working journalism. I was just a fan who, you know what I'm saying. I bought a ticket, but I was there to take it all in because I was beginning my journalism career.
Yeah, you didn't have the access, but you were there.
There you go.
Incredible flying knee, you know, iconic moment. Feels like these days one of the last times we remember a BJ Penn iconic moment, so that's getting hard to swallow. The following year, we had the start of the Machida era with Machida beating Rashad Evans, one of the most vicious knockouts on his record for sure. And then what you mentioned Evans versus Rampage. To me, that was a dud of a fight. Obviously, I think the build was tremendous. The Season of Tough was the only one that the drama meant anything to me. But the fight itself was a bit of a dud. Rashad kind of wrestled him and controlled him, and it didn't end up paying off in the way that we thought, you know, but that seemed like we were getting a blood feud and it turned into a grappling match. So I don't know if that one paid off. I wouldn't mark that as a moment. But to me, and this was controversial at the time that I did it on a previous show that we've done together. I said my fight of the year in 2014 was TJ Dillashaw over Henan Barão, even though it was a one-sided affair. The impact of that moment, the impact of that moment, that fight, to me, reverberated throughout the year and was such an incredible moment. And now, obviously, we have to look at that, you know, with different glasses. But TJ Barão upsetting Henan Barão, TJ Dillashaw upsetting Henan Barão at UFC 173 was one that really impacted me at that time. That was one of my all-timers.
Do you feel differently about that moment now? Because I actually did a top 10 for the show on Tuesday, and I was like, do I include this?
It's hard to say because you can't look back that far and say, clean, not clean. You can't really make that determination. It's impossible to really make that judgment. But TJ Dillashaw as an overall product is tainted in my eyes. There is certainly a different lens when you look at all of his fights. Now, whether I can say that performance stands on its own or not is, you know, subjective. I don't know the answer for that. I don't know how I feel truly. At the time, it felt like one of the biggest things that had ever happened in UFC history. And you know, a champion who was being called by the time at Dana White and many others believed, at least if not the pound for pound best, one of the pound for pound best. And TJ Dillashaw made it look like he was going to gym class. He completely schooled him. At the time, it was you know, the magnitude was unbelievable. Now looking back, I don't know how to feel about it. I truly don't. But I do know that TJ Dillashaw as a product, his legacy has been affected by that.
I would argue that over the last 10 years, there have been better moments on Memorial Day weekend than July 4th weekend. They've tried to make July 4th weekend into, you know, the Super Bowl card of the year, but they've actually, I think, have had more success. And a lot of this is timing. A lot of this is just luck and how the cards play out. But when you consider some of the other moments that have happened, you know, DC winning the belt for the first time at UFC 187, when you consider the TJ Barão fight, when you consider the first one that kind of kicked this whole thing off, UFC 60, Matt Hughes versus Royce Gracie, that was in LA, but still Memorial Day weekend. You mentioned 84. There have been some amazing moments, and I'm just like, you know, remember the all heavyweight card?
Yeah.
Remember that UFC 146 and a bloodied, Bigfoot Silva just getting annihilated by Cain Velasquez. There are two that I wanted to mention, and one's under the radar or underrated. And another one everyone knows, but there's a reason why I remember it. I will never forget Brian Stann beating Jorge Santiago at UFC 130 and dropping to his knees while everyone is chanting and showering him with the USA, USA chant. You remember that?
I do, yeah. Now that you mention it, it's been a minute, but wow, yeah, that was a powerful moment.
That was incredible, considering the fact, of course, that he's a former Marine. That was an amazing moment, and I will never forget watching from home the coverage of Rampage Jackson versus Chuck Liddell, UFC 71,
yeah,
and watching the weigh-ins on ESPN, and watching SportsCenter while Brian Kenny moderated a debate between Joe Rogan and Lou DiBella. Do you remember that?
Oh, yes. Wow.
If you have never seen that, go on YouTube, type in Joe Rogan, Lou DiBella. And that was surreal as an MMA fan. Seeing MMA being discussed at length on SportsCenter was just absolutely surreal. And then seeing Rogan, our guy, right? That was sort of one of the faces of the UFC, a staple of the coverage, go up against DiBella. And I love Lou DiBella, but Rogan got the best of him that day. Like Rogan, like Lou tried to come off as you don't know anything about combat sports. You don't appreciate boxing. And then he started to like throw up Pernell Whitaker references and whatnot. Willie Pep and all this stuff.
On energy alone, Rogan kind of just dominated it. He just, you know, overpowered it.
Yeah. So I remember watching that and just being in awe, like, wow, I can't believe they're actually talking about this. The whole premise was, is MMA the new kid on the block when it comes to combat sports? And of course, it was coming off the fact that Liddell had just been on the cover of ESPN, the magazine, had just been in Entourage. He had been all over the place. And now all of a sudden, you know, this is his big, you know, this is his big moment to actually cement himself as one of the like mainstream superstars in sports right now. And then of course, 24 hours later, he gets knocked out. And that was fodder for people to say that like, you know, in the UFC, they can't build stars. But I remember watching that and being like, holy smokes, this sport has arrived.
Yeah. And if you were a true MMA fan, it was no surprise that somebody like Rampage could do this. Obviously for the outside world, yeah, the fall of Chuck Liddell in that situation, might have been a shocker. But obviously, if anybody had been following Rampage's career, this was the fight to make. This was the fight that people were clamoring for. And Rampage was by no means, out of this fight. This was one for that was easily winnable for him. And he proved that to be true. I think, you know, what you were describing to me, it sounds like Memorial Day is the one for the hardcores. And, you know, July 4th is the one for the rest of us, the casuals.
Maybe.
That's how we pin it, and we keep getting these amazing Memorial Day cards.
Let's have a little reunion here because we're all in this festive, nostalgic mood. Let me do this. Let's go to Rio de Janeiro, Brazil right now and say hello to our old pal, our former colleague, the man, the myth, the legend, the incomparable, the inimitable, Brazilian beast, Guilherme Cruz. Guilherme, are you there?
Hey, Ariel, how are you, my friend?
Oh, my gosh. I have not heard this voice in quite some time. How about this? We've got New York Rick on the line. We've got Guilherme Cruz. We're all over the place here. It's great to hear from you.
It's great to hear you, too, man. And New York Rick as well, who wasn't real earlier this month for the UFC. You weren't here. So I guess I just had to meet him along him real, not with you.
Yeah, you had to settle.
You don't like us anymore.
I felt the word settle coming as well, but it was incredible to meet Guilherme for the first time after having worked together for so long.
Guilherme, let me ask you, did you show him a good time? Or maybe I should ask New York Rick if Guilherme showed you a good time. Did you show him a good time, Guilherme? Did you take him to the spots, BB Sucos, all that?
No, I did not. He went by himself to BB, but I made sure to tell him to go more than once. He didn't go full area on this. Like going 7 times in 3 days.
that is accurate. I did not go 7 times, but I did make a handful of appearances.
I'm putting you on the spot here, Guilherme, because I didn't have you on to talk about this, but I was just curious because I like to get all nostalgic. And if nothing comes to mind, I won't hate you. But do you have a favorite Memorial Day weekend? So Memorial Day weekend is this weekend here in America where they have all these events like UFC 187, DC, and Rumble, Vitor against Weidman, UFC 73, we were just talking about, TJ and Barral. Do you have a favorite Memorial Day weekend UFC moment?
It's funny that I don't have a favorite one, but I always remember the ones that I didn't like because it's always close to my birthday. So in the past, I always had to cover the events from home, watching it live on TV, and had to write about them, and sometimes it was on the same day, you know, on the same night of my birthday when I was having barbecue at home. I have like 50 friends over and I couldn't drink beer because I had to work at night. So it always remembers me, the Memorial Day events, because of that, because I couldn't work, because I couldn't just have fun because I had to work at night. So that's why I always remember those UFC events.
And that reminds me, we should wish you a happy birthday. Happy birthday, my friend. How old are you now?
Yeah. I'm 32 now. Thank you.
Wow, 32, the Brazilian beast. That's amazing.
Yeah, I'm getting old.
Yeah, well, not quite where I'm at, but I'm actually shocked that you've done as much as you've done at just 32 years young. All right, New York Rick, great to talk to you as always. I'm going to have a one-on-one here with Guilherme, so I don't want you to, you know, get in the way. I don't want you to be a third wheel.
So. I'm going to see myself out, but yes. You guys have some fun, and good to talk to both of you.
All right, so there's New York Rick. Thanks as always to him. Now, Guilherme, I wanted to have you on to talk about the state of Brazilian MMA because I feel like you know, maybe at the beginning of the year, there was this talk that Brazilian MMA is struggling these days. You know, where are the stars? We have Amanda Nunes doing her thing, but where are the other names? Where are the male fighters and whatnot? And all of a sudden, I feel like things are doing well. And I actually feel like people are confused. Like they're focusing on the wrong things. They're focusing on Anderson. They're focusing on Jose Aldo. They're focusing on Little Nog. You know, what was going on at that event just a couple of weeks ago in Rio. But if you actually take a step back, and you focus on Jessica Andrade, and you focus on Johnny Walker, and you focus on Thiago Santos, and you focus on Michel Pereira, who just came out of nowhere on Saturday. I feel like Brazilian MMA is doing pretty well. Not a lot of champions, but I feel like there's a lot of prospects, a lot of potential stars. Do you agree or disagree with me?
Yeah, I agree. It feels like a moment of transition in Brazilian MMA. If you want to look at bigger stars, the ones that casual fans in Brazil will tune in to watch, yeah, it's not a bad time in Brazil right now with Anderson Silva losing, Jose Aldo losing, Rio, Little Nog, and all those legends in Brazil. But if you look as a whole, as fighters with potential to win titles, this is a great moment right now for Brazil. We have three UFC champions, Jessica Andrade and Amanda Nunes, with two titles. So we have two champions with three titles right now in the UFC. We have a couple of fighters getting ready to fight for belts like Thiago Santos and Marlon Moraes. We have a lot of fighters climbing the rankings in many divisions. So if you're looking for big names that are gonna draw attention from the casual fans, yeah, it's not a good time. But we have a lot of fighters with potential right now to be the next guy.
How popular? Yeah, and so that's where I wanted to ask you. How popular is Jessica Andrade after what she did? So the night was not going well for Brazilian MMA stars, and then she comes out and she wins the belt against Rose Namajunas. And I know since then she's popped up on TV shows and whatnot. How popular do you feel like she is as a result of that win?
Given the nature of the finish, how impressive that was, how horrific that finish was, everybody was talking about it. She wasn't on TV shows on Monday, on Sunday, so everybody was discussing that. So she she's so friendly. So she's always smiles. So she's such a nice person that I think that helped her to connect with the Brazilian audience. So I think that given how she won, the fact that it wasn't real, the fact that all the Brazilian legends were losing, and she was the one to finish the night with kind of saving the night for Brazil here in Rio, it really helped her to transcend to another stage in her division, right, in her career right now.
She told me on Monday that, and I was blown away by this, I loved it. She said that, I asked her, who do you want to fight next? Who do you think should be next if they gave you the opportunity to pick? Because we have Michelle Waterson who's calling her out. We have Tatiana Suarez who wants to fight her, and everyone thinks she's a future champion. She's fighting Nina Ansaroff on June 8th. And she said something amazing. She said, I'd like to repay Rose for coming to Brazil, and I'd like to defend my title against her in Denver. I'd like to go to her hometown and fight her there. And I was like, wow, that's a pretty amazing thing. Like, you would never hear someone say this. What did you make of that when you heard her say that?
It shows her. It shows who she is. Like, she's so honest, and she likes to do the right thing, even if if Rose the one to stick around, she does deserve a rematch in my opinion. So giving that chance to her in her hometown would be great as a sport, like with returning the favor to Rose, and also would be smart in business wise, because she came to Brazil and she lost, and now she's coming to her hometown. It would be for Jessica as well a good decision business wise. So yeah, it does not surprise me that she has that idea.
She also told me that, you know, Joanna is trying to get another shot against her. Joanna beat her at UFC 211 when she was the champion, and she said, I think that she should fight a few more people and not try to cut the line here because there's other people that deserve it. And I was impressed that she said that as well because, as you mentioned, Jessica is so nice. She doesn't really ruffle feathers, but she was essentially telling Joanna, like, to chill out. Even though you beat me, you really have to go back and start picking up a few wins at 115. Were you surprised that she said that?
No, I wasn't, because especially with what Joanna said after the fight. She, like, congratulations her on the win, but like posted a picture of her getting head kicked. So it was like her way of saying, okay, I understand what you're trying to say, but no, stay on the line and try to get a win before you earn another title shot. I talked to her after the fight, and she was like, she feels that Tatiana Suarez is the biggest threat in the UFC division today, in the strawweight division today. So, but she has a big fight ahead of her now. So she kind of feels that if Rose is not coming back for another fight right now, maybe the winner of Tatiana and Ansarov should be next, not Joanna.
Who would you say is the biggest Brazilian MMA star right now?
That's a complicated one because Anderson Silva and Jose Aldo are still the two biggest names. So even though if they're losing or not, they're the ones that as the stars will bring the biggest audience and will draw more, even though they are losing more than fighters that are holding titles right now, like Amanda and Jessica.
Okay. Do you think he'll fight again?
Jose Aldo, think he will. Anderson Silva, I don't know. I think he eventually will, but I'm more confident that Jose Aldo will come back, yeah.
Do you want to see Anderson fight again?
It depends on what the UFC does with him. If they keep booking him against the likes of Adesanya and Jared Cannonier, I'm not interested in seeing that anymore. If they go for fights like, okay, Vitor Belfort is no longer the UFC, but someone like him, someone like GSP, someone that has this history, is a fellow legend, that fight, and someone is older as well, that fight I would be interested. But someone like Jared Cannonier, that does nothing for his legacy, I don't think they should do that. I mean, the Cannonier fight came out of nowhere. No one expected that. No one truly understood what they were trying with that booking. So, and the way it ended, so no one gained with that except for Cannonier that came here to Rio, got a big win off Anderson Silva as well. But, I mean, they have to think carefully with what they are going to do with Anderson Silva next. And also Jose Aldo, who has only one fight left in his deal, what he's going to do now that he lost and he's not going to fight for the UFC title again, especially going off a lot. So who is going what is he going to do now that he's coming off a loss?
Okay, so now let me ask you about some of those fresh faces, and I'm still blown away by Michel Pajeda. And I first learned about him not that long ago after his win in December, but if you missed it, he had this amazing debut on Saturday against Danny Roberts. The guy is crying on the way to the cage. He's doing like all these crazy moves during the intros, and then during the fight itself, he's doing more crazy moves and ends up just steamrolling Roberts, breaking him mentally and physically, and even tried to flip on him, but the referee stopped him afterwards, which would have been disastrous because he would have been probably disqualified. How long have you known about Pajeda, and has he always been this way? Because like you look at him and you're like, who could beat this guy? But you look, he has almost double-digit losses on his record, so it's not like he's indestructible. But you know, clearly he's on some kind of a roll right now, and his confidence is super high. So again, how long have you known him for, and are you like surprised that he's doing this in the UFC now, that he's still doing these antics?
I first heard about him last year, one of his wins in South Korea, that he was doing all this trick and all this crazy stuff in the cage. And that, I kind of expected him to go for it in his UFC debut, but I wasn't expecting him to win, especially like that, the first round with a flying knee knockout. That was and especially with who he was matched up against. Danny Roberts is no joke. He's a really tough fighter, and I expected Roberts to take more of a intelligent approach and a smart approach in going for takedowns, not stand with him. So I was impressed. I was impressed with the way he won, but I wasn't surprised with what he was trying to do in the cage. But yeah, he's been doing that for a long time. When he first got those wins in South Korea and made some headlines in the U.S., I was talking to a friend of mine who covers more the original scene here in Brazil, and he was telling me that he has been doing that for a long time here in Brazil and got some heat for it, because when he's doing that and he wins, okay, people are going to love it. But when he was trying stuff like that and lost, people was calling him like a clown, telling him to go back to circus. So it wasn't very everybody loving him all the time for his this stuff. And, but now then he got in the UFC and he won. People are showering it with praises.
Yeah, and it sort of reminds me of Michael Venom Page here in America when he fights for Bellator. Of course, he's from England, but every time he does that stuff, people are like, oh, just wait. And then he gets knocked out against Douglas Lima. And people are like, oh, of course. This guy, Pajeda, has 9 losses on his record. He has 2 fights that went to a no contest. So, again, it's not like he's invincible. But if he can keep this going, and he looks much older than 25. He's only 25. He looks much older. He's huge in there. Did you see how big he was? His manager told me that he weighed 198 pounds in the fight. For a 170 fight, that's insane. That's unbelievable. How far do you think he can go? Like, do you feel like he's a real prospect as far as, like, is he in the category of a Johnny Walker, or do you think that he'll only go so far?
I think it depends on where, when he's, in which division he's going to fight next, because he used to fight at 185 and even heavier catch weight. So staying at 170, he can be that active. Because that's a huge weight cut for him. So if they decide to stay 170, it depends on who he's going to fight next, how long he's going to be his break between fights, or if he moves up to 185 to stay more active. So if I think it depends on those situations and what he's planning to do next. But I really don't know, because Johnny Walker, when he got in the UFC, he had that great debut against another tough opponent in Argentina, and then he was matched up against I don't remember his second opponent was
Johnny Walker.
He also won.
He had Khalil Roundtree, right?
Yeah, but no, the second one. I can't remember the second one. And then he was matched up against Sirkunov. It was a fight that the UFC wasn't willing to give him because they thought it would be such a big step up in competition for him. But they really campaigned for that and got this fight, and he just did that. He won in second. So I think it's going to depend on what Michel Pereira can do next in terms of who he's going to match up against and which weight class he's going to fight. But he was promising. I don't know if it's championship material, but it's going to be fun to watch whether he wins or loses.
Yeah, the second one was Justin Ledet. Roundtree, Ledet, Sirkunov. Speaking of Walker, I haven't checked in on him in a while. What are you hearing, if anything? I know I'm putting you on the spot here about when he might return.
Yeah, last week he went to the U.S. to see a doctor to get his shoulders checked. They were expecting to get cleared to go back to training right away. But the doctor didn't clear him just yet to get 100% back in training. So he can do a few things, but he can't go 100%. So he's not quite ready to book a fight right now.
Okay. Let me ask you about RDA, who had the big win on Saturday over Kevin Lee. He was on a 2-fight losing streak, facing another wrestler. It seemed like a bit of a crossroads fight, but I thought he fought really well. A, were you impressed with what he did? And B, who would you like to see him fight next?
It was interesting, his performance, because I didn't like the matchup at first because they were booking him against another wrestler. And the way the fight started, like Kevin Lee started really, really strong, pressing against the cage and all that. So, but as soon as Kevin Lee started to get tired with the fighting the new division, RDA was able to get this move going and get the takedown and then finish him. So, It was a good performance, but it wasn't as great as I think he was hoping for. Puts him in back to title contention. Not right now. I mean, of course, he has to get a few wins to earn another title, another shot of the title. But it was a good win to get him more confidence and motivation.
You think Thiago Santos has a shot on July 6th?
That's a tough one. He has to go crazy, in my opinion. He has to get in there and get in John Jones' face and try to knock him out in the first round, because John Jones is more technical than him on the feet, more on the ground. But Thiago Santos, he's really hard. So, I mean, just go crazy on him. Try to rip his head off and see what happens, because the longer this fight goes, the better it's going to be for John Jones, in my opinion.
I know this just happened, but what's going on with the weight cutting? PFL with three Brazilians didn't make weight. Is that accurate? Was it three?
Yeah. I just read on Newsday. I was waiting for PFL to get back to me with the weighing results. I think I just got an email on them about this. And I was talking to Alexandre Bezerra, who was the fighter that missed weight by 9 pounds.
Whoa.
And the thing is, I spoke with him. I just texted him, and he said that he passed out while cutting weight. He was in the hot tub trying to cut weight. He still had 7 pounds to lose, and just passed out. His coach took him to a local hospital, so that's why he was 9 pounds over the limit.
That is scary. Reminds me of another Memorial Day. Yes, Hanna Barão. Yeah. There you go. It reminds me exactly of that. That one didn't happen on Memorial Day. It was UFC 177. But when I think of Barão Dillashaw, I always think about that fight at UFC 173. Guilherme, you're the man. It has been so great to hear your voice and catch up with you again. You continue to do amazing work. It's incredible the amount of work. You had an amazing feature on Jessica Andrade before her fight. So keep up the great work, my friend, and thank you for doing this. We'll talk to you soon. And happy birthday.
Bye. Thank you, man. It's a pleasure to be on a show. I'm happy to see your success over at ESPN.
Thank you. There he is, the Brazilian beast himself, Guilherme Cruz, joining us from Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. All right, in a moment, we're going to check in with my now former colleague, Shamat Karsandu. But first, let me tell you about our good friends over at Ancestry DNA. Have you ever wondered where your family comes from? You can discover more about them and learn more about your family story by combining the Ancestry DNA test with billions of historical family records. Ancestry DNA gives you so much more than just the places you're from. Ancestry connects you to the places in the world where your story started using precise geographic detail and clear-cut historical insights. I was waiting for the music, and there it is. Now I feel a lot better about all of this. Also, you can trace your ancestors' journeys over time, following how and why your family moved from place to place. And to amplify your results, you can start a free trial on Ancestry and build a tree so your ancestors become more than just a name. In fact, our producer, Daniel, I believe, has taken the leap and has actually gone through the whole Ancestry DNA process. Is that true, Daniel?
That is accurate, Ariel.
Tell us more.
I found out from doing my Ancestry DNA test that my great-grandfather Charles Kessler, in the 1940 census, I found out that he was a car shaft inspector.
Wow.
So basically like drive terrains and things like that back in the day when, you know, not like everybody had cars in the 40s. They were starting to become more popular. But I can literally look in this census. I can see what his yearly salary is. I'm looking through so many different things, all of his children. And not only that, but it tells me when I look through everything where the majority of my ancestors came from. I'm 88% from basically the British Isles or Germanic Europe. So being able to look through and just see where all of my ancestors migrated from. And this is just scratching the surface. I haven't even been able to delve deep into everything like this. But
wow,
right off the top, really exciting just to be able to find out where you came from. You know what I mean?
That's incredible. Yes, they've combined DNA results with over 100 million family trees and billions of records. As you just heard, one of those great examples from Daniel to give you more insight into your genealogy and origins. Only Ancestry can tell you such a rich story with unique features that gives you a more complete picture about a person, events that shaped them, how they made a living, and what they excelled in. How about that? What did you say it was?
He was a car shaft inspector. So like drive terrains. Yeah.
Wow. That's amazing.
How cool is that?
Yes. Go to Ancestry.com/MMA today for 20% off your Ancestry DNA kit. That's Ancestry.com/MMA for 20% off your Ancestry DNA kit. Ancestry.com/MMA. Support them because they support us. All right. Let's go to Long Island now because that's where our next guest, he is not living in on Long Island, but he is there right now for PFL 2. But he has been going through a lot over the past 24 hours or so because he put out the announcement that he is leaving MMA media. He put this out yesterday. He put it out on Tuesday. And everyone was like, oh, no, you're leaving MMA media. And then today he comes out with the curveball and says, well, I'm sticking with MMA. I'm just kind of going to the other side of the fence. I'm going to be working in social media for PFL, Professional Fighters League. And if you've been listening to this show or my other show, you've heard Sandu on. He was just on like, I don't know, maybe a month and a half or so ago. He's been a great friend over the past year since I joined ESPN. He's done so much for me behind the scenes, so I couldn't be happier for him. But I wanted to know more about this move. So let's say hello to my good pal, my mate, Shamatkar Sandu. Sandu, how are you?
I'm great, Ariel. It's great to hear your voice. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Congratulations on this. Mazel tov. This is a big deal for you. So I was first curious about the decision because, you know, you can't work for a promotion and still cover the sport. You have to pick a side. And so you have decided to now go on the other side of the fence, as I said. What was that decision-making process like? How difficult was that for you?
It was actually easier than I thought it would be in the end. When I kind of just took that 10,000-foot view of, you know, what's happening in the industry, where are my potential opportunities, this just was the perfect fit. It really was. And I've made no secret about this, but even my entire career covering the sport as a journalist, from starting a blog to a YouTube channel, from, you know, working for MMA Junkie and Fighters Only all the way to ESPN, it's never been full-time. You know, it's never been full-time. It's always been part-time, freelance, just doing my contributions, doing what I can to be a part of the team. And, you know, a long time ago, somebody said to me, hey, look, if you really want to make it in sports media / MMA media, you got to move to LA, you got to move to Vegas, you got to move to New York or Bristol, Connecticut. And, you know, as you're going to go through life, you have to just figure out what you want in life and what are you prepared to do and what are you perhaps not prepared to do. And for me, My biggest goal, one of my biggest goals in life was to always move to Toronto, Canada. My wife is from there. I love Toronto. I made that move 6 months ago. Very happy, settled there. But I was not prepared to make one of those other big geographic moves to another big sports market / media market. And I knew by making that kind of decision that perhaps long-term, full-time opportunities would be limited. I mean, I saw that coming up in the game covering MMA in London. Right, which is another, you know, massive media market, but not so much for MMA in terms of full-time position. So with all that being said, I was very comfortable and happy. Don't get me wrong, I was very happy with everything that I was doing. And then this opportunity came out of nowhere. You know, I wasn't, if you asked me 6 months ago, hey, you know, you're going to end up working for a fight promotion, I would have laughed at you. No chance in hell, you know. I would never kind of cross that boundary because, you know, you can't do both. And that's why I decided yesterday, you know, when I kind of committed to the PFL, that I will no longer be a journalist. You can't, you know, you've got to choose to be on one side of the fence or the other. But the opportunity itself to help drive social media, content creation, videos, digital content, it was brilliant. It was perfect. That's me all over. That's right in my wheelhouse. And to still be able to live and work in Toronto, that was huge. The overall package, everything just ticked every single box. It's literally like a dream job situation for me. And yeah, I'm excited to be here. PFL 2 goes down tomorrow evening on ESPN and ESPN Plus. And I'm just kind of getting acclimated, you know, meeting my new teammates. And there's an amazing team here, by the way. And everyone comes from fantastic backgrounds in the social media team. We've got someone from the WWE. We've got someone who's ex-Spike TV / Paramount TV / Bellator. We've got someone who's ex-Complex. So a great variety. And there's so much enthusiasm and energy, you know, from what I've seen so far. And I'm just, like, raring to go. It's such a good vibe over here. So yeah, I hope that kind of, in a long-winded way, answers your question.
It does. And so tell us exactly, what are you doing for them?
So I'm going to be part of the team that's going to be cranking out social media content, producing our own IP. We're going to be creating a lot of video content and so stuff that you see on Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, things of that nature. Helping tell the fighters' stories, helping, you know, tell the story of the PFL, but also ultimately, you know, serving a master where we have a broadcast partnership with ESPN Plus. And if you look at the landscape of the industry, that's where everything is being shifted to. You look at Bellator's partnership with DAZN, the UFC and PFL with ESPN Plus, and every other, you know, sports league and franchise, WWE Network. how you can use social media to help drive subscriptions, get new audiences to actually pay attention and make that financial commitment month by month. That's a challenge that everyone is talking about in the industry, and social media marketing is a big part of that. But it can't just be about that. You've got to have some fun with it. It's got to be interesting and fun and intelligent. Pay attention to what folks like on social media. At the same time, like I said, try and raise the profile of these fantastic athletes and these fighters, tell their stories and tell their journey as they kind of go through this 2019 PFL season. And so that's what I want to be a part of. And that's kind of conversations that we're having of how can we do that? How can we be different from everybody else? And how we can, achieve one of our objectives.
So right now, if you're talking about American mixed martial arts promotions, you have the UFC, you have Bellator, you have PFL. I think everyone would agree they're in that order. What would you say, you've been there, this is essentially your second full day, but I know you've been talking to them for around a month or so. What would you say is the vibe of the company right now? Because I feel like you guys are sort of the underdog, right? You have this big opportunity to be on ESPN, but you have to create stars. You have to get people emotionally invested. You have to get people to know who these fighters are in these tournaments, not just Kayla Harrison. There's a whole bunch of other ones. I think there's 72 or some or some number close to that in season two. And so, how would you say the vibe is right now as far as the company, as far as, the enthusiasm as the second season is kicking off? And B, I think you have maybe the toughest job because the season is already set, right? The season, the matchups are all there. We know what's going on. We know the cards. We know how it's all going to play out. But now you guys, the social media team, I feel like you have the toughest job because you have to now get people interested in these moments, get people aware of the moments after they happen. This is a tough thing. And so I'm first, I want to ask you about the mood, and then I want you to answer about if you already have an idea how to go about this, or are you still kind of figuring it out as this whole thing plays out?
Well, number one, the enthusiasm is very, very high. Honestly, I mean, everyone is just buzzing. We're just kind of already kind of talking shop and throwing some ideas around. And so energy, enthusiasm, very, very positive. And that's across the board, not just in social, folks that I've spoken to from other departments. Everyone's very kind of, it's a very encouraging mood to, what's happening at the moment with the organization. There's been some other additions. There's some fun things planned for tomorrow night. Here in Long Island, which I can't talk about right now, but will be kind of addressed, I guess, on the broadcast and social media. You're absolutely right. It is a challenge, but that's exactly why I've been brought on, and that's why there's going to be some other additions to the team. And those are the kind of conversations that we are having right now. Like you said, this is my second day here, and I'm just getting to know my teammates, figuring out, what they've actually kind of got on deck right now. And we're just going to start to get our creative juices flowing. And see what we can do with our roster. And the thing is, with the way the season plays out, there will be some interesting things that we can use in terms of the narrative. When we kind of go into the second half of the regular season, there's going to be moments where a fighter, for example, may be entering the second round of a fight. And if he or she doesn't get a finish, they know, and we'll all know on the broadcast, that's it. Their season is absolutely over. That's compelling stuff. And how you can convey that on social media is something we talk about, and how we can actually address that and tell that story. But also, we only have, one event in the book. Event number two takes place tomorrow, and there'll be a maximum of eight more events throughout the year. That's it. We're not going to have 20 events, 30 events, or 40 events. So how do you utilize your roster? How can we, work with this incredibly fun, and diverse, interesting personas and personalities and create some awesome content that we could roll out in between events? There's going to be months and weeks where there are no PFL events, but we still got to keep all of our, accounts active and interesting and keep that kind of flowing. And that's a big challenge. And that's the kind of conversation that we're having right now. But it's a challenge I think everyone is up for. And I'm very enthusiastic and, I think positive in terms of what we have planned, given some of the early conversations that we've had so far. And like I said, this is my second day, but I've got a lot of my own ideas, resources, connections in my own personal network that I'm hopefully looking to bring on board. And we're going to try and do things that you haven't seen other fight promotions do. And you know what? Some may be hits, some may be misses, but we're going to give it a shot. We're going to try to be authentic. We're going to try and really have a positive and engaging connection with our audience and the fan base.
I know you said you never got a chance up until now to cover the sport full-time or work full-time in the sport, but you have been to a lot of events. You've been around the sport for a long time. What was your favorite event to cover, favorite event to be at, favorite story to be around to cover? Is there one that sticks out?
Well, that's easy. UFC Fight Night Dublin, the coming out party of one Conor McGregor. It was the first time I'd been to Dublin. The fans there were just incredible. It's an atmosphere that to this day, of all the events that I've been to, hasn't been matched. It was SBG's night, you know, plus we had, you know, just an amazing, it was almost like one of the, you know, I've got this video that me and Abby, my old, you know, partner in crime, made where we kind of spoke to you and other members of the media following the event. And you can just see everyone gushing with just so much energy from what they had just witnessed. And it's a video that, you know, every now and then I'll watch, you know, when it's the anniversary, I'll kind of go back and watch it. But, and there's a great picture. I think Pete Carroll's got a picture of, you know, Connor and Dunny and, you know, Neil Siri and all these guys just sitting on the stage in the press conference backstage. And it's just, it was a beautiful moment. It was a great moment for the UFC European team, but also the European MMA media. That's where I came from. Those moments covering big events or getting the opportunity to cover big fights in Europe, especially in MMA, were few and far between when I was kind of coming up in the game. Only fellow European MMA members of the media would understand, but we all knew that what we were witnessing that night, that week, was historic. That was a fight night card that kind of got a headline. And look at what he did in the aftermath. But that's my favorite event. That's my favorite experience, hands down.
Great choice. I'll never forget that one. That might be my favorite event as well. That was a magical night. And it just all came together. It was really great. And I remember those moments with you and Abby. And it was just so great. I'm so happy that I got to cover that one in person. I'm so happy for you as well, my man. Enjoy it. Good luck. Congratulations. Well done on what you've built over the past 7 years, doing it on your own, doing it your way, trying to be different. Well done. And I think this is a brilliant move on PFL's part. So I'm really curious to see how it all works out, but I have no doubt that it will be great. So get back to work. Do your thing. Good luck tomorrow night. Good luck the rest of the way. And congrats on your first full-time job in mixed martial arts. And let me just say for those listening, I feel like I have to say it even though I said it on Twitter, you were a really great friend to me over the past year and did a lot for me behind the scenes. All those pictures that I put out, like before the Monday show, the guests, you did that on your own. I never asked you to do it. You kept doing it, even though I told you didn't have to do it. You were a great sounding board and confidant. And I don't know how things would have worked out for me here in the early days, if not for you being around. So I really want to thank you publicly for everything that you did and for being such a great friend. We knew each other. We would talk, you know, at the events, but never on the level that we've gotten to know each other over the past year or so. And I just really want to thank you for that. And I couldn't be happier and proud of what you've been able to do and to get this job as well.
The feeling is mutual, Ariel. Like you said, you know, up until a year ago, we were kind of like colleagues and peers in the industry. But I'm so grateful that we formed a great friendship over the last 12 months. I'm going to be rooting for you and cheering you on from afar. I know you and the rest of the crew at ESPN are going to do an amazing job covering the sport at a very high level. So the feeling is definitely mutual. Before I leave, if I can just share one quick story, if you don't mind.
Sure.
When I made my announcement yesterday, I was overwhelmed with emotion, number one. I got calls and text messages and DMs. And I hope he doesn't mind me sharing this story, but I got a phone call from Michael Venom Page out of the blue. Here's a guy that just suffered his very first loss in the most brutal fashion not too long ago, just over a week ago. There's memes and videos going viral about that knockout. And here's a guy that called me to find out what was going on, to thank me for, you know, for covering his career. And let me just say, he's in the greatest mood ever. This guy is going to come back and do some amazing things in the sport, I have no doubt. But I just thought that was an amazing moment, and what a character. And I really appreciated him making that phone call, given, you know, what he just went through just over a week ago. So shout out to Michael Venom Page.
That's awesome. And I'm not surprised. He's a great guy, a true mensch. So that's really cool and shows the connection that you built with a lot of those UK fighters. Thank you for sharing that. Thank you for the time and all the best, my man. We'll talk to you soon.
Speak to you soon, Ariel. Cheers.
All right, there he is. Newest member of the Professional Fighters League, Shamatkar Sandhu. Now, at the top of the show, I told you we'd have three guests. In fact, I lied. We have a fourth guest because some things have happened while we have been taping this show, and this will be out in a matter of moments after we're done, so it's almost live, if you will. Daniel does a great job of turning it around. But let's go to Los Angeles because I was supposed to have Mark Raimondi on this week, but then he told me he was busy, but now he's no longer busy, and I want to know what the heck happened. And so, Mark, are you there?
I'm here, Ariel. How are you?
Mark, what's going on in L.A. today?
So I'm in downtown Los Angeles at L.A. Live near the ESPN office here. Tony Ferguson, the UFC lightweight contender, former interim champ, was supposed to have a media lunch this afternoon, and he canceled abruptly this morning, citing logistical issues getting down to L.A. Of course, he lives in Orange County, about an hour away from here. So I'm here preparing for a Tony Ferguson lunch that now will not happen. I've been told, though, by the UFC that the fight is on. There's nothing to worry about with that regard, but there will be no Tony Ferguson media lunch on Wednesday.
Do you believe that there's nothing to worry about?
I think so. I think there's nothing to worry about as far as the fight happening from what I've been told, and I'm fairly confident in that. It is a bit, I mean, granted what we know about Tony Ferguson and what has been going on in his life over the last few months, it is a little bit troubling that he was not able to come to L.A. to do this media day today. The fight is very soon. So I think it will happen, but it is a little bit troublesome that he's not doing media just yet.
I will say that I wasn't 100% surprised when I saw this, when I saw that you said that the lunch had been canceled abruptly. I've been trying to talk to Tony for quite some time. We all know about some of the personal issues that he's been through. We've talked about it on this show and other shows. And I feel like maybe he doesn't want to speak to the media right now because maybe he is reluctant to talk about those incidents. I have not had any success, as you can probably guess, in getting him on the Monday show. But, you know, you do kind of want to see Tony. See, my biggest issue with this fight and the booking of this fight was it felt like it was happening too soon. Why? You know, it's very rare that the UFC puts together a fight of this magnitude on 1 month's notice when it's not a replacement fight. And so why is it happening so soon? And is Tony in the right spot mentally, physically? Is that enough time to prepare for a comeback fight? Where's the coach coming out and saying we're good? We haven't really heard much of it other than some tweets. So I can't help but wonder if everything's okay. I want to hear from him. I hope he's okay. I know his management team very well, Balanji Group. They're telling me he's okay, but like you do kind of want to see him and hear from him, right? Just to be reassured that everything's okay, correct?
Oh, very much. And that was one of the reasons why I was anticipating today's media lunch, because just to have him in front of us and to see where his state of mind is, to ask him questions, to just hear him. I mean, in kind of a way, Ariel, like I was hoping to see the old Tony Ferguson, you know, cracking jokes and laughing and being kind of goofy. I was looking forward to that Tony Ferguson. I thought the Tony Ferguson that was talking to the media before UFC 229 was incredibly entertaining, and I would like to see that old Tony back in good spirits.
Yeah. So as of right now, no word on if they're going to reschedule or anything like that?
Nothing like that, but I was told just now that he will be available for interviews.
Okay.
I guess it was just a logistical issue getting down to LA today. So I'm being told by the UFC now that it isn't that he's not doing interviews; it's that he just wasn't able to get to Los Angeles this afternoon. So I will try. I will try to reach out and talk to Mr. Ferguson. I hope to chat with him soon.
And now let me ask you about something else that just happened. MMA Junkie reporting that the Nevada Athletic Commission has decided to reduce the suspensions of Abubakar Nurmagomedov and Zubaira Teguhov, who were involved in that brawl at UFC 229, and they had a one-year suspension that they were facing, of course, that was retroactive to October 7th when the event happened, and we remember that Khabib Nurmagomedov said he would not return until their suspension was up, and now all of a sudden they want Khabib to fight September 7th in Abu Dhabi, and so how about this? all of a sudden, their suspension has been reduced by 35 days, and they're now free to return on September 2nd. They've already paid their fines. Habib has paid it for them, the $25,000, but they now must complete 10 hours of community service, this being reported by MMA Junkie. But they can return on September 2nd, and oh, by the way, the Abu Dhabi event is September 7th. Are you kidding me? What is going on here? This is, and this just happened, but come on.
Clear. What is it's going? Pretty clear what's going on, Ari.
I mean, this is as blatant as it gets. No,
it's pretty obvious. I mean, Khabib Nurmagomedov said last year that he would not fight again until after his teammates were eligible to fight until they were off their suspension, and they figured out a way to make that happen, and it happened today in Las Vegas.
But the Nevada Athletic Commission, who was so strict about all this, who said 1 year suspension, now here we are, months later, you're going to reduce it for what? For 35 days, just so, and we know that they're going to put those two guys on the card because Khabib is going to be on the card. Those are his guys. They're trying to market to that community, the Muslim community. It all makes a lot of sense. I get it from a business perspective, but like, how do you justify this? Based on what? And why 35 days? Why not 30 days? Oh, because 30 days wouldn't fit, right? I mean, I have a hard time swallowing this one.
I have reached out to Nevada Commission Executive Director Bob Bennett and have not heard back. I reached out to him last week as well, did not hear back on this. I will keep trying. I mean, what they're saying, according to MMA Junkie, is that the request was made because those two men, Takugov and Abubakar Nurmagomedov, were not offered community service initially in the adjudication agreement that was originally come to. That's what they're saying, that's why it's getting reduced, because they were not actually offered the ability to do community service. So that's the company line right now. I don't know more than that.
35. It reminds me of like the John Jones deal from last year where it fits so perfectly for him to return to MSG. Of course, he didn't return an MSG, but it's like these random, like who gets a 35 day reduction? Like it's either a month, 2 months, like 35. That makes no sense. 35 days? What? Come on, guys. You should have just done 2 months so it like fits a little nicer. Not 35 days. If you're going to try to sweep things under the rug, at least be a little like less sloppy about it.
It's pretty blatant.
I call shenanigans, Mark.
It's pretty transparent.
Yes, it's very transparent. Unbelievable. Well, that just happened. The Tony Ferguson thing just happened. So we wanted to get you on in the final minutes of the show just to update us on this. I like breaking news. I like when things happen in the midst of the show and we have the ability to talk to people. So good luck out there in L.A. I hope things are okay. I hope you don't get lost in downtown L.A. Here it could be very intimidating.
I think I'll be all right.
All right, Mark. Enjoy AEW this weekend.
That's right. How come you didn't ask me about Double or Nothing?
Because I don't want to lose all of our subscribers. I've been told it's the fastest growing podcast at ESPN. I feel like if we talk pro wrestling, everyone will unsubscribe.
Wow.
That's right.
Wow.
I said it.
Maybe we can do a wrestling podcast.
That'd be nice.
Reporters.
I'd be down for that. But we'll talk about that off air.
Tim Piramonte.
It'd be great. It'd be awesome. No one would listen. It would be amazing. Thank you, Mark. I appreciate it.
Bye, Ariel.
There he is, Mark Raimondi, joining us at the last minute. Just a couple other notes before I say goodbye. Juan Adams is fighting Greg Hardy in San Antonio. That's going down on July 20th. So that's the next fight for Greg Hardy and a bit of a step up in competition. So we'll see how he performs in that fight. New main event for June 29th is Francis Ngannou against JDS. They're moving that fight from the July 6th pay-per-view to June 29th in Minneapolis because Robbie Lawler versus Tyron Woodley fell through, and Robbie Lawler just at this point wanted to fight either Woodley or Ben Askren, so they had to move and get to JDS, which honestly is, I think, a better fight than the original main event, so I think that the fans in Minnesota shouldn't be all that upset. And finally, Conor McGregor did an interview with Tony Robbins that actually was taped in early April, but it just got published this week for some reason, and everyone going all gaga over the things that he was saying. He was saying essentially that, pertaining to Khabib, this isn't over, we're going to fight again, all that and more. He said that before the fight, that it won't be over, that we will fight again, all that and more. So I'm not all that shocked by any of this. But he did also say that, he regrets the training camp he was so defensive in the training camp. Like, all they were talking about and thinking about was being on the defense as opposed to the offense, and sort of alluded to maybe some of the stuff that has been said since the fight about a rift between him and John Kavanaugh and his coach. And it seems like all is good now, that he needs to, he just needed to maybe figure things out and listen to himself. But it seems like the team is still going to be intact, and whenever he returns, they will be together. As far as when he will return, we don't know. They want him to fight July 27th. That's not going to happen. They want him to fight Pettis. Not going to happen. Gaethje's out there doing the thing where the UFC tries to get someone to call out Conor. They want him to fight Gaethje, so he goes out, he does this thing, the same thing that Cerrone did. I don't know if that's going to work, but I suspect by the end of the year, we'll see him fight again. Against who? Not sure. When? Not quite sure, but he wants to fight. He's not retired. He wants to fight. Make no mistake about it. Conor McGregor wants to fight again. They just need to figure it out. And I don't think he's going to fight in Abu Dhabi. So maybe October in Las Vegas, maybe November MSG, around that time frame. Maybe December pay-per-view in Las Vegas. One of those, I feel like, is a good bet for when he's going to return. They got to figure out the pay-per-view thing, the structure, the payments, the new structure, the piece of the pie. All that and more has to be figured out, but I think they will at some point. Anyway, we're out of time. Thanks to all our guests this week. It was a fun show. It flew by. Thank you very much, New York Rick. As always, thank you very much, Guilherme Cruz. Great to catch up with him. Congratulations to Chamatkar Sandhu. And thank you very much to one Mark Ramundi for jumping in at the last minute. Again, eventbrite.com, eventbrite, BRITE.com. Search my name. You can get tickets to our live show June 7th. It's going to be great. It's going to be lit, as the kids say. Can't wait for that. We'll talk to you next week. Enjoy your weekend.